Okay, good morning, everybody. We'll start our February board meeting. We're going to start with a disclosure initiative. I give the floor to Catherine.
Thank you, Hans. Okay, good morning, everybody. So we are here today to summarise all of the feedback we've received on the principles of disclosure discussion paper. Back in December, we brought a preliminary high-level overview of the feedback to the board, and today we've got the full detailed version of that feedback for you. We won't be asking any questions today. We're going to save that for next month when we will be asking the board to make decisions about next steps on the project. Now, as you may have noted from the agenda papers, we have got a lot of information to share with you today. So we've organised the feedback into a number of agenda papers to organise the discussion. The first two of those papers, 11A and 11B, summarise the feedback we've heard from users, and then the rest of the papers summarise all of the comment letter feedback from other stakeholders, section by section of the DP. So we're going to start with the feedback from investors, and we will tee up the papers in groups of two or three to move the discussion forward. So I'm going to start by teeing up agenda papers 11A and 11B, and then we will pause for discussion. So the feedback we had from users was based primarily on the investor outreach programme that we performed along with the investor engagement team during 2017. And we also received 8 comment letters from users. You can see in agenda paper 11A a summary of that outreach programme. And the purpose of that paper is really to provide the board with context to understand exactly where the feedback from users has come from. In total, we met with around 190 investors and analysts to talk about the topics in the DP, and that included a range of users, both by geography and by type of investor. The feedback itself is then summarised in agenda paper 11B. Users provided more feedback on some areas of the DP than others, and I will highlight now the areas where they had a lot to say. So in terms of the disclosure problem, many users said that for them the main issue is a lack of relevant information, and they're more worried about what's missing rather than any concerns about disclosure overload. They would for the most part support disclosure of more information rather than less. And they also highlighted problems around ineffective communication and the application of materiality to disclosure. Most users agreed with the principles of effective communication that were described in the DP. They highlighted comparability and entity-specific information as being particularly important, but they did have mixed views about whether they thought it was important for the board to mandate those principles. We got a lot of comments from users about location of information, so that's IFRS information outside the financial statements and non-IFRS information inside the financial statements. And many users agreed that both of those things can be useful in some circumstances, but they did have a number of concerns. So, for example, they were concerned about the risk of understandability being impaired if there is too much cross-referencing to information outside the financial statements, and they were worried about the risk of misleading non-IFRS information finding its way into the financial statements. We also got a lot of feedback from users about the section of the DP that talked about performance measures. Some of them said they thought those considerations would be more appropriately addressed in the primary financial statements project. They also encouraged the board to define one or more performance measures, although that itself wasn't specifically mentioned. And most of them supported the board in developing definitions of and requirements for the presentation of unusual or infrequently occurring items. Another area that most users supported was the development of requirements about which accounting policies a company should disclose, and they highlighted as particularly important accounting policies that relate to material items or that provide insight into how a company has applied judgments. And finally, many users thought that in addition to the topics that were covered in the DP, the board should consider the effects of technology and digital reporting on communication between a company and its users. They didn't go into detail on this topic, they more raised it as something that the board could think about. And a few also noted that advancements in technology do not reduce the need to improve communication in traditional financial statements. So with that, I will pause for any discussion on agenda papers A and B.
Yes. Thank you. Yeah, you did a really outstanding job to get some kind of investors feedback, because this is the first time I saw 190 is greater than 108 comment letters. It's awesome. So it's a really surprising now their efforts to collect all kind of investor feedback. So basically, I wondering whether investors think that there is some problem with the disclosure, because we started with this project with in mind a kind of information overload. But based on this 190 investors' feedback, they don't think there is any overload issue here. So this is a kind of quite opposite idea to preparers. They think there is an overload problem, but investors do not think so. Based on discussion paper on and their feedback, we maybe need to evaluate whether there is a really information overload problem in markets.
I might just comment on that, and you can correct me if I say anything incorrect, Fred, but just to clarify, I think in terms of the DP, we did raise a number of quite specific topics for people to comment on. So when we go back and look at the beginning of the project, we had a huge amount of feedback from investors then about the disclosure problem, and now that we were asking them specific questions, but putting all of that together, you know, they do have a number of concerns, and I would say it's more the case that they weight the lack of relevant information much higher. You know, they don't love the obscuring of information, but the thing that they primarily talk about when you ask them what they would change is the things that are missing.
I think that's fair. I think also disclosure overload from the perspective of some of the investors we met with is potentially linked a little bit to technology. So we did have some investors express the view that the use of technology just makes it easier to consume a lot of disclosure information, particularly search functions and PDF or other types of databases, and therefore some of these detail-oriented investors, real power users of financial statements, they don't express a big concern with disclosure overload.
But I think that's consistent with what we heard right back when we did the forum, right when we started the project, right? That there was different sort of variants of the disclosure problem, and I think fairly consistently from the investor community, we've heard not enough relevant information as their concern. So for me, it sort of reinforced what we always have seen, which is the perception of the disclosure problem is quite different if you talk to investors versus if you talk to preparers and others.
Anne?
Thank you for the papers and the team, and really excellent work. I'm interested in this idea of entity-specific disclosures and comparability. So that's come up in something that the users have said, and it comes up elsewhere in the papers. And I'm wondering, in all the feedback that you've got, have you got more information that's going to help us progress? Because I see those things as somewhat conflicting, people wanting things to be comparable versus wanting entity-specific information. So have we got anything under this in the feedback that's going to help us progress and decide how to weight those two things?
We have got a lot of different comments on those two things and some varying views. I mean, some people do take the position that you can't necessarily mandate those things on companies because they are difficult to comply with both, and it would be difficult to enforce compliance with both. There are also some that think achieving comparability is the job of the standard setter rather than companies, so perhaps it's for us to think about comparability when we're setting future requirements, and entity specific information is perhaps more about materiality and the onus on companies. So we do have some feedback to work with in terms of how to move forward, but I wouldn't say there's a clear consistent message coming through from everyone.
Okay, thank you.
Jen Chow.
Thank you, Hans. First of all, I appreciate that the user's feedback is really helpful for us to guide in which direction of the next step of this project. I have several questions. First, the user said that they are concerned about that there are no enough relevant information, and they give us some examples in paragraph 18. I would like, because those examples is still too general, I would like to have some specific or detailed requirements from those users, such as they need, you know, more relevant information with regard to the segmental reporting information. Also, they need further information about the fair value. As we all know that we have done the PIR with regard to IFRS 8 and IFRS 13. The general feedback we got is both of the standards quite good, provide useful information for the users, but they still think that they need, you know, more relevant information. So whether there are any specific or detailed relevant or useful information they needed, it will be helpful for us to improve our standards. So this is the first question. Second question is with regard to paragraph, I think 52, about the presentation of the EBITDA and the EBIT. The users would like us to define one or both of the EBIT of the EBITDA. I'm wondering whether there are any preferred measures between the EBIT and the EBITDA. This is the first question. And secondly, secondly, they also said that they thought an IFRS defined profit measure would provide a useful IFRS measure for performance measures. I'm wondering what kind of IFRS defined profit measure they need. Is the profit and or loss or comprehensive income they need it, or any other profit measures they would like to define in IFRS? And then the paragraph 55, it seems that many users particularly would like to have have the board consider the other performance measures such as operating profit. Yeah, and during the outreach, whether we have detailed background or information about this performance measure, such as in which jurisdictions or how many preparers they provide this kind of operating profits measures, and how they define and what kind of component included in operating profit, and whether they audit or whether they any regulator requirements of this kind of items, something like that. I think this kind of feedback and detailed information would be helpful for us to move forward what kind of performance measures we needed in with regard to our project. This project will be primary financial statement project. Thank you.
I will just say a couple of things in response. I mean, I think all of the issues that you've raised in terms of a more granular level of information from the feedback will almost be relevant when we analyse the relevant topics and make decisions about moving forward. So I'll provide a few comments in answer now, but we will, you know, look to answer those things when the relevant discussion happens. But in terms of your question about paragraph 18, where we listed some of the topics investors had raised, when we spoke to them, they did give us some specifics about what they would have wanted. It's just that we didn't want to go into that level of detail here. So these were examples of the topics they raised, but we do have more information on that, and I would have the ability to ask for more if it would be helpful. And then in terms of performance measures, I think with your question about a preference between EBIT and EBITDA, I didn't get that from the feedback. I'm pausing in case.
It's difficult to qualify from the feedback we gather if there's a preference. At our most recent CMAC meeting, we almost had a discussion moving in an area where the membership urged the board to work on both, and the view was EBITDA has become so popular that there's almost no point in doing work on EBIT and stopping there. You might as well do both. But to, I think, generalize investor opinions on which one would you pick is quite difficult without maybe framing for them what the trade-offs are for whichever choice they express a preference for.
Nick.
Thank you, Hans, and thank you the team for gathering the feedback in such a comprehensive fashion. I guess there's one thing just to be aware of as we go through the subsequent topic-based papers, that obviously when we refer to stakeholders there, given that we've gathered all the user feedback in one place, that excludes the user view as we go forward. I mean, overall, I found the messages reassuring, and also I would be wary of seeing this just about a debate of whether there's disclosure overload or not, with preparers at one end and users at the other. I mean, some of those comments were terms from users about the quality of the data in terms of presentation, in terms of comparability. It's not just about the amount. There were, I think, where users talked about accounting policy disclosures there, I think people are willing to see less. It's not just about more all the time. So I don't think it's as polarized, really, as a battle between users and preparers. So hopefully there's common ground for us to move forward.
Doug. Thank you. Actually, it is quite difficult to find out what is the user's common view, because different users have different view. However, one thing common within the users is they want clarity of the information. What is what? What information means what? So they welcome somehow the more information, the more the better. However, they don't want to mix up information. So they want more information, but they want to know which is IFRS information, which is not IFRS information, which is audited information, which is not audited information. And also, they welcome entity-specific information, and also they welcome the judgment made by the management. However, they want to know what is the assumption of that judgment, what is the basis for the judgment. So then, the one thing very common within the users is they want the clarity of the information. So I think that is the job of a standard setter. So the direction, what we have to do is to provide clarity, and I would say quality, of the information. So in this sense, your paper was excellent. Thank you.
I would certainly agree with what Hugh reminded us. I mean, the fact that users have called for greater relevance as being their main issue has been the one particular factor. And that I think we see it here. And I would also agree with Nick that when users express concerns about ineffective communication, when they express concerns about whether materiality is applied appropriately, they implicitly are referring to information that obscure the relevance of what should be more prominently identified. And so I fully agree with Nick that there is not such an opposition. But I also think that they highlighted that despite the volume of requirements that we have, they still miss information, so that entities will just, you know, in their compliance mode eventually not feel requested to provide information that is not precisely listed. So I think everything, to me, the lessons is really how are we going to help entities provide, put the effort in bringing relevant information to users, much more than the volume issue per se.
Gary?
Thank you. Well-written set of PET papers, by the way, and impressive job with analytics. Just a few comments and a question. First of all, actually, similar to some other comments, I was actually sort of reassured in general these things that we're working in the right direction in it. The investor outreaches I did, I would certainly agree with the comment, is they're more concerned about what's not there than what is there. But also the same meetings, I think there's they truly don't want irrelevant information in there, but they would like that decision to be made by themselves as opposed to the preparer, let's say. And in that sense, they sort of get a little bit nervous about dropping even small numbers, because it might be material to somebody situationally for something. So that was sort of my takeaway. They prefer the decision made by them, what's the material, which means you provide it. I think on question on accounting policy notes, just reflecting back as a preparer, they certainly bulk up the document or have the wherewithal to be. But quite honestly, they don't take an awful lot of time to do. They tend to be boilerplate once you set your policy, and these most programs are recurring and so on. So if we're going to worry about or work on what do we do about location accounting policies or what are material, I suggest we don't think in terms of the workload to actually do. It doesn't get a lot of workload. Maybe sometimes you've got a quantitative number buried inside one, but in general it's text. I think on the paragraph 18 about their suggestions of where to do, and although it wouldn't be in the scope of this project, I'll just say it for the record. C, effective foreign exchange on financial statements. For multinationals, that in itself affects an analysis to truly understand it. You take in translation, transaction, hedging, derivatives that economically hedge but not accounting hedge, and the impacts of cash flows and accruals, based income at different times. It is, I can assure you, it is not, the numbers might be very exact. To understand them is anything but an exact science, and what to make of them. It really gets into your sources, your supply chain, and stuff like that. So for all those things, I absolutely sympathize with that one. The other ones, I think, we've addressed in our standards, I think we've recently addressed, for most people.
Sue?
I actually also agree with the point that both Nick and Francoise have made. I don't think we have a conflict as such. I think that you could have more relevant information in financial statements and still have shorter financial statements, because you've got less of the irrelevant stuff and less sort of checklisty stuff. So I just think it might be a harder thing for a preparer to work out what is the more relevant stuff to input, but I don't think they're necessarily in conflict at all. The thing that worries me a little bit, though, or at least I'd like to understand a little bit better in terms of whether we have a challenge ahead, and also for us to think about how we write things going forward, is a comment that comes up a lot in investor comments, and it was in the paper, about wanting more comparable information. Because I'm never quite sure what that means, because to me, and I always use IFRS number, expected credit losses, I could say I've got the ability to make comparisons if everybody is providing me with the information that enables me to understand the sort of key assumptions that I've made to calculate my expected credit losses and, the key changes from last time, but they may do it using different cuts of information, different formats, different ways of presenting it, but you'd have the information there that would enable me to make a comparison. So that's one form of comparability. But I think sometimes what also comes up, if you look at something like the Enhanced Disclosure Task Force, when the users were given a lot of ability to influence what particular disclosures would look like, they were very keen on standard templates, that everybody would provide the same template so that they could pick up exactly the same sort of information, like direct comparisons. And I think the latter is a little bit less consistent with the overall push in messaging that we're getting on more principles-based articulation of our disclosure requirements. And I know it's hard to generalise with users, but when they were making their comments on comparability here, what do you think they mean there?
I think there's a 50-50 split. I think there is a quest for uniformity, false comparability, and often when you're engaging with these investors, they don't really appreciate that when you sort of dig beneath the surface, that the comparability is truly not there, especially those that I think really want to jam things into templates. So perhaps we need to develop materials that bring that issue sort of to greater prominence to them of when you're asking for comparability, what does that mean inside of a principles-based system? What can that look like under a variety of scenarios that they're maybe better able to detect what is comparable information versus what's information that they think is comparable but in fact is not.
But they do want more comparable formatting of the financial statements.
That is my...
Yeah, and I completely understand that.
I think there's also a difference between what people, what the users are actually wanting to do with the information, so that there's this difference between the sort of high-level screening where perhaps they want the more consistency in the templates versus the deep dive where perhaps they want that additional information. So they may want both types of comparability at different times.
Mary?
Let me pile on in a good way in terms of congratulations to the team for the outreach effort, because I think it is really important to have what I'll call a 360 view on the issue. You know, also echoing Nick and Francoise about it isn't necessarily a, you know, clash of the titans, but you know, it just it gives us a rounded picture. So very important and great effort. A few thoughts, and I think they're all about follow-up papers rather than questions on this. And going back to paragraph 18 and Jean Dow's comments about, you know, this being high level, I think to bring things back, it would be interesting if you have the information to understand, if I take this list of A to E as an example, whether people were saying it's a problem with the requirements we have in the standard, or whether it's, you know, the requirements are about right, it's about how people are responding to those requirements in terms of entity specific or pulling things together, as I think it has implications for what kind of responses we have. Second, if we get information like this, it would be interesting to know, kind of if you look at this list of five, is it, Gary picked on C, in FX, is there one that's the big one that there's consensus around and then the others are scattered, you know, any kind of order of magnitude break, in a list. Again, don't want it now because I appreciate different purpose of this paper from the follow-up papers. And also sometimes when you go talk to people, they may answer in the, if I were king, this is what I would do, as opposed to, this is what I really, really need and is missing. And so making that distinction. And then in terms of things that we should be thinking about in terms of responding to this, one is to think about, again, whether it's application of the current requirements or the current requirements need to be reconsidered. I think the former implies maybe more education and other initiatives, while the latter implies standard setting. And so let's think about that. And then last on the technology point and the view that users can cope more and more with increasing amounts of information because of search functions, I don't know if the technology is there for them to deal with it today with search functions, or if they're assuming that there's some kind of tagging. I mean, I remember from some of the searches I do, if you're getting really technical, whether you have an S or a Z, whether you have a space, you know, literally if you're doing a search, if different entities use slightly different words, will you find the thing in a free-form search, or has technology advanced enough in this area that it's not dependent on, let's say, a discipline taxonomy and kind of identification of metadata so that people know that if they find zero hits that the entity has none of this, as opposed to they didn't use the right search term. So, you know, so what is that? Yes, search engines can cope, as you know, search technology can cope with it. Is that assuming that there's a structured taxonomy, or is it that it's really there today? So, as I said, I think all comments for follow-up papers rather than today.
All right. Thanks. Let's move on.
Okay then, so the rest of the board papers for this session summarise the comment letter feedback from all other stakeholders. Agenda paper C is really a cover paper that provides some overview information about the comment letters and the analysis we've done. Now, in order to avoid excessive fragmentation of the discussion, we'll tee all of these papers up in some groups. So first, I am going to summarise agenda papers 11D and 11E, and then we will pause again for discussion at that point. So agenda paper 11D presents overarching feedback that isn't specific to any particular section of the DP, and this paper really has three main messages. So first, respondents were concerned about overall project focus. They felt that the DP was something of a piecemeal collection of issues rather than being a coherent vision of how the board will help to address the disclosure problem. Respondents asked the board to prioritise the various topics in the DP, focus the project accordingly, and provide stakeholders with some clear messages about project direction and expected outcomes. Secondly, respondents had some concerns about the interaction of the principles of disclosure discussions with other board projects. They thought the boundaries between the projects were unclear, and they had some concerns about potentially unhelpful overlap. They were also concerned about separating discussions into different projects, and in particular that related to separating considerations about disclosures and materiality. Thirdly, many respondents commented on the potential implications of technology and digital reporting. Although this wasn't addressed in the DP, respondents thought the board should consider disclosure issues in a digital reporting environment within the scope of the project. Agenda paper 11E then talks about the disclosure problem and what the board could do to help that problem. Respondents had some quite strong views in this area, with just about everyone agreeing that there is a problem and the board can help to make things better. The reasons for those views were varied across stakeholder groups. So preparers, unlike investors, were most concerned about disclosure overload, which they say is caused by excessive requirements and prescriptive language. Many of the stakeholders highlighted behavioural issues, and in particular they thought the root cause of the problem was largely to do with a failure to apply judgment around materiality. In terms of what stakeholders think the board should do, the DP itself talked about the development of disclosure principles in a general disclosure standard, and respondents had mixed views about whether they thought that would help to address the problem. So the most common view that we heard was that that would help, but that it would not be enough alone. And many respondents supported the board performing a standards level review of disclosure requirements. Again, standards level review is something that we did not raise in the DP, but nevertheless, respondents thought that would be the most effective thing the board could do to help solve the problem. So paragraphs 28 and 29 of the paper summarise the broad range of things that different stakeholders thought a standards level review might be used to do. And many of those reflect feedback we had about the way the board drafts IFRS standards. In addition, some stakeholders, and in particular preparers, thought that a standards level review could be used to remove requirements that they considered to be excessive. And finally, some respondents also commented on the possibility of the board developing guidance for the board itself to use when developing disclosure requirements. So some refer to this as a disclosure framework and say that that could be used either when developing future new disclosure requirements in new standards or to facilitate any standards level review if the board decided to go down that route. They also thought that the approach of developing guidance for the board would lead to more consistent and coherent disclosure requirements across the standards. So again, we will pause there for any questions or thoughts on agenda papers D and E.
I'm out of it.
Thanks, Hans. I would also say thank you to the staff for the set of papers, very comprehensive. And in reading all of them, that I think I would like to make my comment on this particular set of papers that deal with scope, because the result of my reading of all the papers is that I'm truly confused. Yeah, I'm truly confused because I think there are some aspects that
I believe, are clearer now to me after the discussion paper. One of them is that almost everyone agree we have a problem and the disclosure overload or the language. But I think there are some messaging to me, like applying the judgment in materialities as being one of the key problems. So in terms of scoping, I think I would like to see an assessment of staff if or identifying aspects that we should consider to be a standards level development, aspects that we should focus on in terms of education, like the materiality judgment, and aspects where we identified now with the feedback, if we have enough, that we shouldn't go further, but the boundary might be established between what should be our effort and what should be the responsibility and effort of others, in particular regulators. Because sometimes I think my feeling is that we are crossing some boundaries in aspects that they are important, of course, but we shouldn't really devote too much time, because at the end of the day we'll be crossing what would be ideal as an accounting standard setting process. We might find difficulties or even being challenged in a way that make it impossible for us to reach an agreement about the concept, because at the end of the day this would be under the lap or on the lap of local regulators and standard setters. So after reading all this, I'm not clear where should we go in terms of scoping, because I think it's the discussion paper opened up too much for us. So I think I would be expecting some more clarity, as a word that we've been using, about what the staff believes are the right paths in all these levels or times.
Yeah, well, I think it's very interesting that when we developed the disclosure paper, the principles of the disclosure paper, the staff was struggling, the board was struggling to give sufficient focus to it, and our constituents have clearly seen that. And when you read all the papers, it's clear that we do have to give more focus to it. It's also clear that a lot of the issues that we discussed in the original discussion paper, we have taken up in primary financial statements, so that already allows us to cut loose of a couple of these topics. But it is very clear that our constituents are as confused as we were, and that we have to pause and think what we need to do. Sue?
Building on that and just reflecting on 11D first, and then I'll comment on some of the things Amaro said. So the irony is not lost on me about our own communication challenge and our better communication project, because all of the criticisms in 11D, I think, fall at our feet in terms of how good a job we've done, and I include myself in this. It's not directed at the staff. I mean, as an organisation, in terms of helping people understand how this all fits together. And I think we really need to up our game going forward in terms of our own communication and really go above and beyond and making it clear that we've taken feedback on relevant bits of the principles of disclosure discussion paper, for example, and we're sort of feeding them into the PFS project real time. So people can see that, yeah, we're a bit out of kilter on timing, but it has been helpful to get the initial feedback on things like the alternative performance measures, because we can use it straight away and it's not going to go to waste. You know, the timing does still work, but we need to really do a better job of our own communication on that. On Amaro's comments, I must say I had some similar thoughts, and the thing that really makes me pause when I read all of these papers is that we do have a not insignificant group of preparers who actually are doing a good job communicating based on our existing requirements. So I don't think it's impossible to pick up our existing requirements and to apply them in a thoughtful way and to produce good documents that communicate to the market. And sure, we could have written things better and we could have made it easier by using different language and not making it sound like at a minimum and all of these things. But that to me suggests that, a lot of this is behavioural. And so what worries me a little bit is I think there's a lot of a push from people in terms of their expectations that they'd like us to go through a standards level review, which I'm a little bit worried means deleting a whole load of disclosure requirements, because they think it's an overload problem. Whereas I think if we were to do anything, we're going to try and sort of become more objectives-based and sort of emphasise what it is about the information that is relevant and useful, and we're going to build on the work we've done on materiality and all of those things and try and pull it together. But what causes me to pause a little bit is I think that that's going to make it even more of a behavioural challenge, because you need to be... It's really hard to pick up standards like that and to apply them. You really need to step back and think, and you need to have a really good ability to apply materiality and to think about relevance, to put your yourselves into the shoes of users of financial statements, to do a good job with those sorts of words to apply a set of financial statements. And I worry a little bit that if it's difficult to pick up our checklist and checklist-style writing and look through that and realise materiality and all of these things apply, if you're challenged with that, I worry you might also be challenged if we move to a more-ish sort of drafting. And so I think the behavioural aspect is huge for us, no matter what we do with the drafting. And so I think we're going to have to think quite creatively about what the next steps are to respond to that.
Anne?
I think we opened ourselves up for feedback, and these two papers really... allowed lots of people to raise points about what we do, and so give directions and suggestions and commands in relation to what we should do. And to some extent, we can consider all those things, and to some extent, we may decide to respond specifically to things. But as has already been alluded to, there are others who are working with what it is we produce. So even if we were to create principles and disclosure objectives, there are others that work with it. And the preparers are under the spotlight because they have contributed a lot of feedback, but also to a lesser extent, their auditors and regulators that are in here as well. And I was interested in the comment in one of the papers from New Zealand people who had been trying to do this and made the specific comment that it doesn't just involve what the standard setter does. So what I take away from all this feedback on what we should change is that now people have put forward lots of ideas, and it's a particularly difficult task to respond to them and achieve the objective. And I think we have to still clarify what the objective is, and we've been asked to do that. But we could respond in a piecemeal basis or on an ad hoc basis, little things here and there, but I think we have to keep our eyes on any response actually achieves the objective, which we seem to agree what that is, bearing in mind that there are all these other stakeholders that will influence our success in achieving the objective.
Doc? Thank you. I think we have to take seriously the disappointment shown by the respondents from the constituents. The point they're disappointed is they don't know what is the output of ourselves, what is going to be changed. It is not clear. And actually, we are saying we have to change the behavior of preparers. That, as Sue pointed out, actually, it is quite difficult. If I looked up my life, my previous life, I didn't think about users' view at all when I was preparing financial statements, because they are busy to comply with the requirements, and also we have seen in the 11B, there are a variety of views from the users. Actually, they want more information. The more, the better. So under the situation that users are requiring the more, the better information, it is quite difficult for preparers to make a judgment to omit some of the information. So preparer think it's the standard setters or the regulators' responsibility to clarify what is the critical information, what is not the critical information. Otherwise, they would be disappointed. And then, so what can we do? That is the next step issue. So So whether or not we should go to the standard level change. But I don't think it's a good idea because it would take quite a long time. But I think there might be the possibility that we could provide some educational guidance how to interpret the what is the critical information in each standard. So if we could provide such clarity without spending a lot of time, then we can address the disappointment expressed in their comment letter.
So this was a confession of a preparer. About the user. And I think we have here the crux of the problem. Problem solved. We speak one principle, think of the user. Françoise, she also has a confession to do.
Yeah, I mean, in fact, I can read in the, I can read many things in the disappointment that arises from the comment letters. But I must say I can sympathize with those constituents that call for external level review, because what I see in that call is that they would like us to get, and I would say at last, standard setting mode. So I don't disagree with comments that have been made. I think there is a lot of consensus about the fact that something has to do with behavior. However, even in those cases where a few entities may do a better job and largely in formatting better, I mean, more effective communication, doesn't mean that they're in the conditions to exercise the judgment on materiality in the way they would want to, because they would not feel allowed to. And I think there is something that is really missing in our disclosure requirements. In fact, I mean, if I relate to what Tag just said and your joke, Hans, I think we're not providing in the disclosure requirements the anchor that is necessary to apply judgment on materiality. So if we were providing, if we were identifying what a possible list of disclosures serve as purpose, of what is the information that will be provided to users, so we say objectives, but I think objective must be something concrete, a concrete objective. Must be providing a particular type of information, and that particular list of disclosures may serve that purpose. So the requirement is to meet the purpose, and the list of requirements is the possible means to do so. And I don't think we can do that without getting back to our current disclosure requirements. So I think it's our responsibility to put preparers in the position of taking, exercising their judgment in order to better serve users.
Although I must say, thinking a little bit further about my joke, that you know, when you look at our materiality definition, it really, the core of it is think about the user. Gary?
No confessions from this expert. I think I won't build on the negative reactions. A lot of people who are here because I had the same. They were, generally well-founded. You know, kind of having been with this project, I think the longest in the room. Originally, the pod part of it was a bigger project than it is, but as materiality came out of it, as primary statements came out of it, I seem to recall a few smaller snippets went up to conceptual framework, the IS-1 change. All of a sudden, as you started taking things out, I mean, you know, they tower didn't hold together quite so well, but it eventually came from a high visible, high project to a, you know, medium intensity, medium importance one. And we might have been guilty of overselling it, but I think that was early in its life, but the original statements sort of carried through. So one way to, there are some lessons to be learned how we can operate differently in here, but this is also a project unlike any other one. There's about 8 or 10 individual facets of it broadly under the umbrella of the disclosure initiative, and subjects and content move back and forth between them over time. So I can't envision we're ever going to have something so sweeping in general of a project going forward. So since the lessons learned here should be learned, I wonder, you know, how applicable they will be for most of our projects, very subject matter specific going forward, and so on. Actually, I personally believe materiality is largely behavioral. Now, I'm not sure where the behavior begins and ends. Is it pushing the regulators, or is the checklist mindset the preparers? I don't know, but I still think most of it's behavioral. What I was very disappointed on was in 11E, is it's really up in paragraph 28, remove prescriptive language, the shall disclose, and so on. Really, we addressed every one of those points in the IS-1 changes over 3 years ago. You take that plus, which is now, this would be its fourth year end, that's an effective standard. What that tells me, it didn't get traction, or it's being ignored. That's what that tells me. When you said look at materiality, not in terms of an individual disclosure, but against the financial statements as a whole. And I've used this example before, and I'll repeat it again, things with well. Share-based compensation, it does high visible, you know, high intensity disclosure, but in my former life, it was $100 million a year, but it was $20 billion of operational cost base. You can make an argument other than what the executive is getting and the total number of potential, you didn't need any of the rest of the stuff. But that is not how the world thinks, and it's just decades of habit, you know, and practice building up. But we gave all the tools needed to take things out, short of going through, my last point, short of a standards level review of individual disclosures. And I know in time, we'll, whether in this project or elsewhere, we'll deal with what should we do and how broad based and what should the scope be. But I would think we should just be on the record, be careful what you ask for, because the list could get longer when you're done, not shorter. I mean, the most disclosure decisions we make, they're a subset of a much longer wish list that is probably can be resurrected if we open that subject by people who want more disclosures. And new transactions, new laws, different things have even come up along the way since. So I would not necessarily gamble or bet that the shorter disclosures will end up being shorter when you're said and done. So again, I think time will tell. We may even choose to do nothing, but that would just want to put that cautionary, perspective out in the air.
I agree with you in your emphasis on what we have already done, the changes to IAS-1, which were very important, I believe. Materiality practice statement. Those two alone, I think, are very important. The redefinition of what is material. So we have already done a lot to make it better possible to use judgments for preparers. And
the challenge is, I think, Hans, is if it's on the checklist and we said it's not material, you have to demonstrate it's not material. But again, it's material against the financial statements as a whole, and even taking it the next step further, does it change investment decisions to hold, buy, invest, lend, or so on, which is even still one step further down the line. And we need to find ways to get that out more, you know, commonly, broadly, and so on.
Martin.
And I agree, we have already done a lot with materiality practice statement and the changes in IS-1, but here in paragraph C7, then many respondents said it is still of utmost importance. They see it's still okay, it's like one of the most important projects which we should do, because they think we still have disclosure overload. And then in paragraph 8, then they see okay, express disappointment, because I think they, the problem will not, from the eyes of a preparer, be solved only by materiality impact judgments, because and also what Tucker has said, man, if you have to prepare financial statements in practice, then it is not only what's the final stage issue, what to decide what's go into an annual report in the financial statements, but you have to prepare for that. And if we say, okay, at minimum you shall disclose blah, 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 clearly that is a requirement for your general ledger, for your reporting package, which has to be filled in by 500 subsidiaries and so on. So it is not that I think what preparers are saying is not the final document but you are concerned. It is more the cost benefit to produce this kind of information. That is costly and that is the way they think. And you can only make materiality judgment calls if you have the numbers, because my auditors will not let you know. If you say, okay, based on my feeling, I don't think it's not material, but if you have not collected the number and showed it is not, from a quantitative perspective, also immaterial, you have no chance. And therefore, I think that expresses a kind of disappointment many have given us, because they think, okay, if we don't address this kind of, on a standard level, think, okay, of our detailed disclosure, what to require, they will not resolve the problem. And if we do, well, in the future, a lot of maybe judgment materiality, if in their feeling we don't reduce the number of disclosure requirements, they have not achieved something in this project. And that is for me the big question. And the question is, how should we do it? And I said already when we started the project, I think also when Stephen was here, maybe we should do a kind of an example. Take one of the standards which people are concerned, detailed disclosure, and try. Because I also think it will not try to reduce. I think also it will not lead to an excessive kind of number of reduced disclosure requirements. But at least many expecting that. And why not try to have a kind of an example in what the pension disclosure or whatever takes this kind of the older standards and say, okay, what would we do if we want, say, okay, allowing more judgment, allowing more disclosure objective of that, and then reducing the number of specific disclosure requirements. Because if we don't do that, I think, personally think, we will not give a sufficient answers to many of this project. Because we can always say, okay, use more judgment and materiality, but in practice it is, and that is my experience, is difficult. Because if in a standard is they disclose this kind of information, then you have to ask in a reporting package for this kind of information, and then in the final stage maybe you don't disclose it in your financial statements, but at least you had done all the work, and additionally you have to take some time to get judgment, or is it material or not. You need discussion with auditors, you need discussion with maybe your audit committee, you need discussion with your CFO. It takes all more time and effort. That is really, people are concerned. It is not if they add a final number in the...
But in Gary's example, share-based payments relative to huge operating costs, is that an exercise then that you have to do every year to look whether it's material or not?
Well, you know what the total share-based payment is. I mean, that's in the ledger. You know, your total operating costs. Yeah. I mean...
Yeah, but I can tell you, for example, in Germany, if you don't have the detailed disclosure of share-based payment, all politicians are behind you and say, why you don't have even its... Not number-wise material. It would not allow if it is 100 million. Clearly, it is from a number perspective immaterial if you have 10 billion of expenses. But from a kind of, what do you pay to your high management? That is really the issue. And even if it is on 10 million, people are interested in that, and you are required to do this detailed stuff.
But my example actually said I would leave that in. That's all you really need.
You have always, but you need to collect the information. You need to have the number.
Can I check what you mean, Martin? Because in a practical sense, so I hear what you're saying. I think that to prove that it's not material, you need to have the systems to capture the data in case you have to disclose it, right? Otherwise, if you turn around and you need it, you don't have it, so you have to collect it. Yeah. So does that mean that we could then only really help somebody if we decided that it would never be a relevant piece of information, so we just take it out of the sort of even being mentioned in the standard, so you never have to collect the information and have a conversation with the auditors? Is that then the only practical way we could provide relief? To be so... I'm just trying to understand how we would be able to help if the concern is you still have to prove it to your auditor that it's
And
not.
I don't have a solution to that, too. But I think especially preparers, think we have too extensive detailed disclosure requirements. And we, by review of our detailed standards, we should reduce it. Because then they don't have to prove in their system to collect the numbers and don't have the discussion whether the audit is material or not. I think that is the expectation. If we can solve it, I don't know. Because as also the paper said, if we may be doing that, maybe we come out with more detailed disclosure requirements. I don't know.
I think the challenge is all of those disclosure requirements, we, the board at some point in time must have thought those were potentially relevant disclosures for an entity, exactly. Assuming it was material, which is Gary's warning.
Well, your point is here you'd have to work to demonstrate it's immaterial, and as I think as Martin is saying, but sometimes it gets hard to prove something that doesn't exist, where to even find the stuff, it's sort of disappointing, but that still goes back to sort of behavioral.
Mary?
A few different thoughts on this paper, particularly about the way forward. It's funny, I also focused on the comment that Gary mentioned, paper 11E, paragraph 28, the comment about overly prescriptive requirements. Gary's take was that means that IS-1 didn't get traction. My take was it just reminded me once again that we're dealing with trying to turn around an aircraft carrier, not a speedboat, in terms of flexibility and responsiveness, because those changes to IS-1 were only mandatory for 2016, and we were doing the outreach in 2017 when people were just kind of digesting the first set of financial statements in which they were forced to think about what the response to those requirements were. And so that brings me to point one is, and it kind of goes back to Sue's messaging about how we're responding to this is a long-term change program. And I think we have to be careful, and this is again maybe reflecting on Sue's challenge about communications, that when we say if we're pointing to behavior changes and others need to change, that it's not us being defensive about, well, we're the good guys, we did the right things, we don't need to change, it's others who have to change. And I think that will amplify the disappointment that Tuck and Martin points to. And so I think it's more a message of there are lessons for all of us in this, and it's our responsibility to both think about how we write standards, but also to provide some leadership or to bring together ways that there can be better understanding for preparers of what information users are users are after and how to respond to those needs, and also that it's a long-term project. I think maybe ask the staff to think about whether the conclusion is, as a second potential messaging point, that our responses are going to be piecemeal, rather than, okay, we see this, we see your disappointment, we're going to have a single major response. I think it's likely Gary enumerated how some different things have been taken out and accomplished, but I think if it is going to be piecemeal, we should be saying that rather so that people don't perceive us as failing to reply. I have some concern about jumping on the standards level review of disclosures. I'm not opposed to it, but I think we have to think very carefully about messages we're hearing in other settings about the cost of change and putting things through a system. And when you think about translation and endorsement, if we've just finished, let me pick revenue. Hopefully we did revenue IFRS 15 better than IS 11 and IS 18's disclosure requirements are. But if we were, let's say, to pick revenue as the one to review, people are just bedding down those requirements. Why would we reopen it? If we reopened every standard that we have, it would be, even though we said we're focusing only on disclosure, it would be mayhem. So I think what we have to think about is how we use the opportunity of looking at standards for other reasons to also think about looking at the disclosure requirements in connection with that, Not necessarily because the other work we're doing on a standard is related to the disclosures, but rather if we are going to look at standard X for, let's say, a recognition and measurement issue for a significant amendment rather than, let's say, an annual improvement, should we say, okay, maybe that becomes a candidate for standards level review because we're already putting it into play, rather than putting something into play, quote, only to do disclosure. The last thing is, it strikes me, and I'd like to ask the staff to think about this, that we're very focused, rightly, on what the feedback was that we heard. But I think one of the things I'm realizing we did not hear, and this is a good thing, is to change the definition of materiality so that I think we have to be very clear in our messaging about materiality. The comments I saw captured in these papers are about the application of the concept of materiality rather than our materiality definition is flawed. And I think that's good. I don't think it is flawed. I think we've thought about it, and in connection with materiality practice statement, that was a pretty good stress test of the definition. We identified some cleanup work we have to do, but I think we should be clear in the messaging that if we're doing work around materiality, it's about the application of that concept rather than hearing a need to reconsider how materiality is defined. So let's just think about that messaging. But sometimes we need to stop and remember what it is that we're not hearing as well as what we are. And so I take it as a positive that we're not hearing that materiality doesn't cope with disclosures. It's about how materiality is applied to disclosures.
This discussion stimulates our thinking very much, and I appreciate that. I have a few comments I would like to make. First of all, I don't think that we will ever respond to the lack of relevant information that users evaluated without getting to a disclosure requirements which are more demanding. And I think the overall what we should aim at is probably more costly than what is provided today. And so to me, what we would be doing in increasing relevance, in demanding greater relevance on preparers, would be an increasing cost. I believe that there would be a huge benefit to that incremental cost, and in fact, it would bring the benefits that are not brought today, even though it's already very costly. So I think the increment is a cost, but I also think that there is a big increment in benefit associated to that marginal cost. That's the first point I wanted to make. The second point I wanted to make is that when I say I'm sympathetic to a standard level review, so I'm sympathetic in us doing something, so getting in standard setting mode. I'm not looking at a standard level review as an exercise whereby we would open all standards, in one go, and consider that the project is closed when we have gone through all of them. And I think that later in the papers there were mention of constituents that thought that we would recommend that we take a standard as a test, because we have to find our new standard setting mode in those disclosure requirements. But I also think that, and that's a point I wanted to make in addition to what I said earlier, is that if our own starting point was not a list of disclosures, but a list of information assessments that users need to make, and that's are going to be served by possible disclosure requirements, I think we would have for ourselves a better discipline in setting the requirements we set, because we would be guided by identified user needs ourselves instead of just providing a list of what could be useful without that anchor. I think the anchor I mentioned earlier would be very, in my view, is necessary for preparers. It's necessary also, in my view, for enforcement, because that's, on those basis that things would be challenged, and not more generally. And it's also a greater discipline for ourselves. So standard level review means standard to me means standard setting mode, and it needs standard setting mode after we have agreed what would be changed in our standard setting mode. So it doesn't mean that we jumped directly at modifying standards.
So you mean first develop principles or?
I think we have gathered a lot of even with the dissatisfaction that constituents may have had with our paper because it was getting in all sorts of directions, providing feedback on primary financial statements in advance, which by the way I find extremely useful. Even with that level of dissatisfaction, I think we have a lot of, and they're probably useful because they're very well displayed, but I think we have learned a lot from this consultation exercise, and there are a lot of good suggestions, I think. I mean, when I read those papers, I mean, here and there I noted down, oh, that's a good idea, that's a good idea, that's a good idea. So I think we've learned a lot, so it would not take ages for us to, in fact, set directions. I think we said two things, set directions for how we would modify our disclosure requirements so that it could be done. And second, define our way of prioritizing the standards are going to come under review, when they are going to come under review, eventually only when the standard is reopened for one reason or another. I mean, we have all sorts of decisions that we can make in order to first say that's the way we're going to test a new way of setting standard, and it doesn't take ages. We don't need principles. I mean, we just need a few directions, a few.
I agree with, I think, just about everything that Françoise just said. And I think that the comment that Françoise made on her earlier intervention about we might be able to help people by sort of explaining more specifically what the objectives are before we get to the disclosures could help them apply the concept of materiality better. So it would give them a better, more specific anchor, I guess, to use. But I do wonder whether it's what they are thinking we would be delivering them. And they ask for a specific a standards level review, because I think that I agree with you that to get more relevant information, I think that's a good approach and helps embed the idea of materiality better within the actual way we'd write the disclosure requirements. But I've had a couple of conversations with the preparers about the new disclosure requirements. We've got an IFRS 7 that go with the expected credit losses, and we've tried to write them much more in that style, and they're not perfect when I look at them. I'm not going to use them as an example because we still use the word shall a lot. But the basic idea is we start off with some more specific objectives about not just about, you know, providing information to understand future cash flows, but to understand, you know, how you've managed credit risk, how it feeds into how you measure expected losses, such much more specific. And then we say you have to provide information to enable these three high-level objectives to be met, and then we give examples of how to do it. And I've had a few conversations with preparers who really don't like what we've done here. And the reason why they don't is they've said to me, I don't understand what investors need to know to understand these things, so I don't know what to do. And I think that's going to be the challenge we have. So I like the idea of this sort of objective-based and then a list of examples, but I think it's quite difficult for preparers to get used to applying.
So demanding.
It is demanding, and I'm not sure when preparers ask us for a standard level review, that's what they're hoping they're going to get delivered.
I think the preparers would like a red pen to be used.
Yes, still specific, but just less.
Doug. Yes, thank you. Let me add a little comment to my confession. I think it's, relating to what the Sue just said. Preparer want to add. Preparer want to put themselves into the shoe of investors, but there are a variety of shoes. So to take one shoe is a risk for the preparer. So in order to avoid such a risk, preparer want to safe harbor always. So that makes the more guidance, and that makes our standard much more rule basis, which we should avoid. So therefore, I still think the principle basis is really important. But the most important principle I think we have to provide is, if you do not think about investors or users, you would pay the price anyway. So if you are not providing good information, the investor can tell which preparers are not behaving well. So then that is the principle we could provide. And then, as Martin pointed out, we could provide some kind of best practices. Even if we don't have to go through all the standard, we could do that. And then that would change the behaviors. That is the point, I think.
Mary, and then we probably want to move on.
Sue, reflecting on what you just said about the IS7 changes as a result of IFRS 9, I think one of the things it's pointing out to me is that we should think about what we do in the period between publication of a standard and its effective date to help preparers understand what information users want. I think it would be too late in the game to think about doing that in respect of IFRS 9 and IFRS 15. I think it may be too late in the game to do that, even in respect of IFRS 16, although maybe we can think about that. And maybe it suggests, though, that we think, as we're looking now at IFRS 17, that we think when it would be helpful to try and do something focused on that, not as set new requirements or interpretive, formal interpretive guidance, but is there anything we can do to kind of convene discussions that help people go from here's the objective and here's the particular area to saying what does this mean that people might want? I think that's an area of activity we should think about exploring.
Okay, we'll move on then to agenda papers 11F and 11G. So to tee those up and presenting to the board for the very first time is Aisha.
Normal rules apply.
Thanks, Catherine. So I'll start with agenda paper 11F, which summarizes the feedback that the board got on developing principles of effective communication. And the intent was for entities to apply these principles when they prepare their financial statements. So in terms of the feedback that we got, most respondents agreed that the board should develop principles of effective communication, and also most respondents broadly agreed with the 7 principles that were described in the discussion paper. And this was because respondents generally thought that the principles would help entities better apply judgment and communicate information more effectively. However, respondents said that developing the principles alone would not be enough to achieve effective communication in financial reporting, and they said that the board would need to take additional action to that effect, much of which we've already discussed them early on. In addition, we received mixed views on whether the principles would address the underlying disclosure problem, with some respondents saying that the principles would discourage things like boilerplate disclosures and therefore enhance effective communication, whereas other respondents said it was not clear to them how the principles would change entities' behavior towards financial reporting. Respondents also expressed concerns about some of the specific principles that were described in the discussion paper. So, for example, the principle on optimizing comparability among entities. Regarding where to locate the principles, respondents expressed mixed views here, with some respondents supporting a general disclosure standard. And those respondents generally did so because they thought it would give the principles more authority and therefore be a more effective way to promote a change in behavior from entities, whereas some other respondents favored a non-mandatory guidance, and to them they did so because they thought it would be difficult to assess whether entities had complied with the principles if they were made in a mandatory format. There were some respondents that suggested something in between to the effect of the board prescribing some, but not all of the principles in a mandatory format, and then describing the remaining principles in a non-mandatory guidance. Finally, this chapter also considered whether the board should develop more detailed guidance on the use of formatting in a non-mandatory guidance, to which we received relatively mixed views from respondents. So while many respondents thought that the guidance would be helpful by highlighting best practices on formatting, there were some respondents that thought that the guidance would be unnecessary and may discourage entities from taking innovative approaches towards communicating more effectively to the users. So the overarching feedback on chapter on this chapter of the discussion paper was one of general support for developing principles of effective communication, but some concerns that the board would need to address before developing anything further in this area. So moving on to agenda paper 11G, so this paper discusses the feedback that the board got on whether it should describe the roles of the primary financial statements and the notes, and how those objectives meet the meet the objective of financial reporting. And one thing to highlight in terms of the feedback in this chapter is that respondents generally provided fewer comments relative to the other chapters in the discussion paper. And of those that did provide comment, they expressed relatively fewer strong views compared to the other chapters of the discussion paper as well. However, of those that did provide an opinion, most respondents agreed that the board should develop the roles of the primary financial statements and the notes, and that such guidance should be included in a general disclosure standard. However, some respondents expressed concerns about how any resulting guidance would interact with some of the board's other projects, in particular the primary financial statement project and the conceptual framework project. Regarding the board's specific preliminary views that were expressed in this chapter, most respondents agreed with using the term primary financial statements to describe the statement of financial position, statement of profit or loss and other comprehensive income, statement of changes in equity, and the statement of cash flows. Respondents also agreed with the board's preliminary views on the respective roles of the primary financial statements and the notes, the implications of the roles of the primary financial statements, and the content of the notes. However, respondents also had some concerns about those specific preliminary views. For example, respondents were concerned that using the term primary might suggest that the notes are less important or inferior to those four statements. Finally, this chapter also considered whether the board should clarify the meanings of the terms present and disclose when it uses it to describe the location of information in the financial statements. To which respondents generally agreed that the board should not prescribe the meaning of those terms, but instead to specify the location as either in the primary financial statements or in the notes when it develops standards in the future. And respondents generally thought that there would be limited benefit in prescribing the meanings because those terms are appropriately understood in practice and well applied. So again, the overarching feedback from those that commented on this chapter was one of general support for the respective topics, but again, some concerns that would need further development before any other area. So now I'll open up to the board for any discussion or questions for us.
Thank you, Aishat. Well done. It was your first contribution to the table. Good. So let's be nice. No comments?
You did such a good job.
Yeah. Total clarity. Okay, well, let's then move on to the next set of papers. Another.
Okay, next we will take agenda paper 11H. We will tee this one up on its own. As you might have inferred from the length of the paper, this is an area where we've received quite a high volume of comments. So the paper talks about the feedback we had on location of information, and there's really two topics within that. So first, I'll mention the possibility of companies reporting IFRS information outside the financial statements. Most respondents supported that in some circumstances, and that tended to be because they thought companies should have flexibility to decide how to most effectively communicate, and that allowing this would help them to avoid duplicate related information together. They also had a lot of concerns, however, some of those related to the particular requirements in the DP, and others were more general concerns about things like audit consequences and how any requirements the board might develop would be applied in different jurisdictions. The other area covered in this paper is essentially the opposite, which is reporting non-IFRS information inside the financial statements. And again, most respondents supported companies being permitted to do that and would not want the board to prohibit it. That's because they think that additional voluntary information is often useful to investors, and many made the point that a lot of companies do this today. Again, however, there were a lot of concerns expressed, for example, about how the board would define non-IFRS information, about the possibility of misleading information finding its way into the financial statements, and about clarity for users as to exactly what has been audited. So overall then, the key message coming through here was one of general support for allowing flexibility around location, but with a number of concerns that the board would need to address if they were to go down the route of developing any guidance or requirements. So again, we'll pause to see if there's any questions or comments.
Mary?
A couple of pretty basic things. One is, I think as you look at follow-up on these papers for the next meeting, my recollection is that this is the comments in this area, ones where it will be particularly important to bring together the information from the user feedback with the views that are summarized here. I mean, obviously that's going to be important for each area, but I have a sense that in terms of trying to figure out a way to balance it, it isn't that there's polar opposites, but making sure we're pulling out the nuances to see where there actually is agreement and maybe some concerns. And the second, I don't have an answer for this, but I did notice that it in terms of polarization within this paper, you know, captured within this paper, it seemed to kind of be preparers here and regulators there. Not all regulators, but maybe stronger views. And it might mean that we need to think about doing some follow-up, particularly with regulators, to make sure that we're understanding what the underlying concerns are, if there are ways to try and address some of the things that they're raising while still responding to the feedback that we had from preparers.
John Wu.
Thank you. Yes, this is a kind of a method on combining all feedback. So maybe in future, you need to combine the investors' response in paper D, or no, B, and the paper D from other preparers. Because, you know, in the case of this, you know, inside, outside the finance statement, not like the investors would like to welcome to include non-IFRS information inside of, and the other preparers also same response, similar response. But in the case of the other paper, for example, you know, the 11G, sorry. That in that case, you know, investors have a different response on the, you know, from the preparer. So next time we have to integrate everything. So almost 300 responses on this subject, then we can have a more exact feedback from the markets, you know, what is the strong views on the each topic.
So
I thought that the feedback on the non-IFRS information gave me some comfort in terms of us asking, I think, the right sort of questions and thinking about the right sorts of issues in the primary financial statements project. I'm guessing we'll sort of circle back and make sure we sort of cross-check the decisions we've made there with the feedback here, which will help with our communication issue raised in the first point. And also on the topic of our own sort of cross-referencing, I was interested by some of the comments made in here about the term annual report and the extent to which it does and doesn't work. And I think, and I'm looking at Neely as I say this, we're going to need to remember to reflect on this in the segments work we're doing and also in PFS. Again, partly to show people that it is important that we've raised it here and we're taking account of our own sort of cross-cutting issues, because I think that complicates some of the things we're doing elsewhere as well. It's not just sort of complicating here. I don't know what the answer is, but it's something to think about.
Okay, thank you. Oh, Martin.
Only one, because when I read this paper, man, I'm still confused what is non-IFRS and what is non-IFRS information. Because man, one example, man, we had, we're saying here in paragraph 37 and so on, category A, B, what is required under IFRS. For example, segment information is required under IFRS. And if you have a kind of, which is used by management, let's assume their key performance measurement is some operating adjusted figure, which I think then is a kind of IFRS information because it's required to include this information in segment reporting. When we're discussing primary financial statements, if the company uses this kind of information as a management-defined performance measure, I think we think it is a kind of non-IFRS information. And this, I think, we have a lot of confusion. And I think we cannot solve this kind of problem if we are, maybe others are, but I'm not clear really what we speak about IFRS and non-IFRS information. I think that's a next step in this. I think we need first clarity what we really mean by that, because otherwise we are lost.
Good job.
Thank you, Hassan. Just following Martin's concern, it seems that most respondents support the board developing a principle that an MDA can provide IFRS information outside the financial statement. But I'm thinking that how can we develop this kind of principle? What kind of information can move out and can be disclosed outside the financial statements? I think we should be careful. From my point of view, completeness of financial statements is very, very important. Maybe in some jurisdictions, there's a legal requirement to have those prepared. They have to provide complete financial statements. So my thinking that if we are going to develop some kind of principle, this kind of principle should be try to minimize those information disclosed outside the financial statement. Even we are going to use some kind of cross reference, something like that, try to minimize this kind of disclosure requirement. This is other reporting requirement what they would like to use. But we are setting financial reporting statements. We should try to keep financial statements as complete as possible. This is my point.
Okay. All right. Let's move on.
Okay. Next is agenda paper 11I, and over to Carleen for that one.
Hi. Agenda paper 11I, this is the feedback we received on section 5 of the discussion paper on the use of performance measures in the financial statements. And going forward, we will use this feedback as input into our primary financial statements project. Now, section 5 of the discussion paper covers three topics, and I'll first talk about the presentation of EBIT and EBITDA subtotals. And here, respondents express views as to whether the board should clarify the circumstances in which the presentation of an EBIT or EBITDA subtotal complies with IFRS standards. And many of those that disagreed with this clarification, they did so because they thought that the existing requirements in IS1 are sufficiently clear. And in addition, respondents also expressed views on whether the board should define EBIT or EBITDA, even though this was not a question in the discussion paper. And many respondents thought the board should define such measures because they said these measures are useful to users and need to be comparable across entities. Now, moving on to the second topic, which is the depiction of unusual or infrequently occurring items in the statements of financial performance. Many respondents said that the board should develop some kind of guidance on this topic, but many said that it would be difficult for the board to develop definitions of unusual or infrequently occurring, and some suggested that such guidance should consist of more general requirements for the fair presentation and disclosure of unusual, infrequently occurring, and similar items. And then the discussion paper also asked whether the board should prohibit the use of other terms to describe unusual or infrequently occurring items, but many respondents did not support this. Some of those that disagreed said that entities need the flexibility in selecting such terms and that entities would just bypass such a prohibition by using other terms. And then finally, there was broad support among respondents for a general disclosure standard describing how performance measures can be fairly presented in financial statements as described in the discussion paper. And with that, we can open up for the discussion.
So
at least we have support for one of the things that we have already done.
I think the evidence in this paper and the previous one are very helpful for primary financial statements. I think we will circle back and consider these things. We've obviously advanced our thinking a lot since the publication of Principles of Disclosure, but I think it's very useful to have this feedback because we can then be citing things in support in basis of conclusion, and then we can also address where people have criticised and said, well, we don't think you should go that way. So it's good. It's useful.
All right.
Okay, we will take the final three papers together then. So to tee those up and also presenting to the board for the first time is Siobhan.
Siobhan.
I'll start with Agenda Paper 11J, which addresses the feedback we received on the discussion of guidance to assist agencies in providing more useful accounting policy disclosures. This discussion was split into two areas, which focused on the development of guidance on which accounting policies to disclose and where to disclose them. While many respondents supported the board developing guidance about which accounting policies to disclose, there was concern about the specific approach described in the discussion paper, in particular the use of categories, which they thought might be confusing or add a level of complexity that they weren't too sure about. Respondents also had concerns about any requirements being overly prescriptive, as they thought it could restrict an entity's ability to really exercise judgment in regards to effective communication. The overall message coming through was that the board would need to do further work before developing any such requirements in this area. While fewer respondents commented on the development of guidance on the location of accounting policies, and those that did had very mixed views. Many respondents agreed that guidance on the location would be helpful. However, some others had concerns. For example, they thought such guidance might restrict flexibility about how to communicate information more effectively. In addition, those respondents thought that the board should prioritise the development of guidance on which accounting policies to disclose rather than developing guidance on where these accounting policies should be disclosed. Agenda paper 11K discusses the feedback received on whether or not the board should develop centralised disclosure objectives to address the content of the notes, and whether the board should consider having that guidance in a single standard or grouped in a set of standards. Again, this section was broadly split into two topics, focusing on how centralised disclosure objectives should be developed by the board and the location of such objectives. Many respondents agreed that the development of centralised disclosure objectives would be beneficial, as they thought it could assist entities in better applying judgment more consistently and would in turn result and promote in transparency, comparability and representation. However, respondents had mixed views on how these disclosure objectives should be developed. In particular, respondents had many differing views on the methods that were introduced in the discussion paper. And consequently, the respondents have asked for the board to provide further clarification and analysis on each method and the effects of their implementation. Fewer respondents provided feedback on the location of centralised disclosure objectives, and those that did provided mixed views and several concerns as well. For example, respondents feared that separating recognition and measurement from disclosure objectives and requirements would create a disconnect, and that the location of objectives and requirements doesn't really address the behavioural issues that were identified to be part of the disclosure problem. Overall, respondents agreed that it would be beneficial for the board to develop centralised disclosure objectives. However, there was no clear consensus on how these objectives should be developed or where they could be located. The final agenda paper is 11L, and that summarises the feedback we received in regards to the New Zealand Accounting Standards Board staff approach drafting disclosure requirements within the IFRS standards. This approach suggested that IFRS standards should include two tiers of disclosure requirements. Many respondents expressed support for individual elements of the approach. In particular, they supported the emphasis of use of judgment and using less prescriptive language within the standard. However, fewer respondents supported the overall approach as a whole, generally because they had concerns about their practical application or because they thought the board should prioritise other areas before this. Those respondents that did support the overall approach suggested that the board perform additional analysis on the potential effects of a tiered approach and provide further clarification around how disclosure requirements can actually fit into each tier. And with that, I will hand over to the board for discussion. Thank you.
Quick comment on paper 11K. So what we have here is some supporting method A, few method B, some hybrid, and even some undecided, suggesting additional analysis. So of course I got confused with this, with their feedback. It's mixed view, that's fine as well. Not everyone needs to agree with us, but made me pause and think, is there really a problem with this aspect? So I would say, yeah, I'm undecided group. I think we do need to perform more to understand if this is really a problem in terms of the issue that we are trying to address.
I was disappointed with these two papers from the responses that clearly, yes, you can do these disclosure objectives, but then no help with the way ahead. Very disappointed that there wasn't serious engagement with B, option B, which was the people lining up with option A. It's as if when you line up with option A, that's just status quo. It's just continuing or tweaking what you already do, whereas B was much more radical. Similarly, in the next paper, looking at the New Zealand approach, it was saying, let's do it differently, let's try and do it differently. And I felt the feedback, I would have liked to see more engagement with those alternatives, how we might make use of them. So a bit disappointed there, and maybe that means we have to do more thinking about it, and I look forward to seeing what you come back with. But I was disappointed that the constituents didn't have more to say about Method B and the New Zealand approach in a positive way, how it might work, how it might help.
I mean, just to clarify slightly, and Siobhan, please correct me if I say anything incorrect. I think One of the difficulties with these chapters is that the feedback was incredibly mixed. So I think in fairness to respondents, you know, they did come back with comments, but they were so mixed there were just no clear messages coming yeah. through. And as Siobhan said, there wasn't really much in terms of explicitly saying these are the kinds of objectives we think the world should go for. And then on the New Zealand Accounting Standards Board approach, we did get quite a number of comments to the effect that people thought we hadn't developed enough for them to be able to provide explicit opinions on whether they thought we should move forward. So, you know, we did get feedback, but it was, as you say, limited in terms of moving forward with it.
Both of those things, Method B and the New Zealand approach, would require a lot of thinking. And when people have got a very big DP to respond to, they may not have the time or the interest in delving into how those things would work, and hence we don't get many comments.
Nick.
Thank you. Just reflecting on the feedback on accounting policies, I think the two issues here, one about the nature of policies and secondly about location. And on the second one, location seems to suggest that a degree of pragmatism is needed here, that some people want to put them together, other people want to put them with individual notes, and I think users cope with either way. I think it was Gary earlier mentioned that he didn't see a problem with accounting policies, but there is a behavioural problem from a user perspective, and that often these are lengthy and boilerplate, and it means that users are increasingly just skipping over them, I'd say. So I think we do need to pay attention to the nature of those disclosures in particular.
Any other comments? Okay. Well, that brings us to the end of this discussion. And some,
Just on the New Zealand one, I just want to echo a little bit what Anne said. Because I thought it was, well, I thought the New Zealand one gave enough for people to say this would be a reasonable path. And people just seem to beg off doing that. I don't know what, when you read it, but because I'm not sure it would take work and all those things, but it was a genuine, I think, attempt to address some of the problems. I must say I was disappointed that nobody sort of really said, yes, this is a viable path or not. Do you guys have any comment on that? Because that seems strange to me that it got so little traction.
I mean, again, I want to stress that to say nobody supported it wouldn't be accurate. It's the case that the feedback was very mixed and across the board. You know, I forget the exact proportion, but, you know, more didn't support it. And we had a lot that said it would need to be developed further before they could pass opinions. So it wouldn't be fair to say that it got zero traction. But when we compare it to many other areas of the DP where there were real strong, clear messages coming through, that just wasn't the case.
Okay. We'll resume our meeting at 1 o'clock with primary financial statements.